Hello and welcome back to the Classics Podcast, and to this first episode of Revision. In this mini bite-sized episode, you'll hear our host James Renshaw talking to two academics, Professor Lynette Mitchell of Exeter University and Dr. Roel Conandike of the University of Oxford. They'll be discussing interpretation question one, why did the Greeks win the Persian Wars? Here they discuss the reliability of the sources that we use for this period of ancient history.
Do the sources allow us to really answer this question very deeply or effectively? Maybe Lynette, can you talk to us a bit about how reliant we are on Herodotus here?
Well, as Greek historians, we are, for this period, we are particularly reliant on Herodotus. The thing about Herodotus, though, is he is a fantastic storyteller, and he wants to tell a particular, very particular kind of story. But sometimes the storytelling gets in the way of what might have actually happened. And particularly in regard to Xerxes, he's setting Xerxes up as a particularly tragic kind of character. And so his whole storytelling becomes skewed around the drama and even the theatre of producing a story about Xerxes, which brings out his tragic nature. So that makes it sort of then difficult, or we've got to sort of step aside from that if we're going to then think about how we can use Herodotus to think about the wars themselves, to sort of get behind that and think about what's history rather than what's theatre and drama.
Okay, that's very helpful. And I guess we should also say Herodotus, we know he's from Halicarnassus in Asia Minor, and he's probably doing his research in, let's say, the 440s and 430s. And we're not entirely sure when he publishes, but the best guess is perhaps the 420s. Would that be right?
Yes, I mean, I go for a date in the 420s for production of it. What publication means is a very sort of, it's a disputed area, and we don't really know when it became a written text. And it may have been, there is a tradition that it was produced orally in the first instance, so at readings of it at Olympia, and some people think also in Athens. So it's not necessarily straightforward. It may be a little bit like Charles Dickens, and you're getting a little bit at a time. But that's just sort of, again, part of the storytelling and one of the things that we have to take into account when we're trying to sort of get behind that to find history.
And he's therefore, what, 50, 60 years after the events? And you mentioned the tragic portrayal of Xerxes there. And of course, there's a precedent for that, isn't there? Because in 472, Aeschylus, the Athenian playwright, produces the play Persians, which actually sets up Xerxes as a tragic hero in the Athenian tragic tradition. So how reliable can we say Herodotus is on the Persian Wars? Is it fair to say that in outline he's reliable, but we have to be really careful with the finer details?
I think that's pretty much true with Herodotus all up, that he's got an idea of how things happened and he's got an idea of what happened, but sometimes what actually happened is less interesting to him than the story that he wants to tell. So Herodotus on Persian history in general, he knows things, but how he wants to tell us those things is a different matter. So it's not quite a question of reliability, perhaps, as because that's not quite the right question in some ways when dealing with Herodotus. We've got to, you know, either step aside from, you know, what he is doing, or sort of try and get behind it, and we've got to understand what he's doing in, so that we can sort of then find history in it.
Okay, well, we're going to try and do that this afternoon. Roel, if we come across to you and think about it from the Persian perspective, trying to understand what their motivations were, I think it's really important to say for students that talking about where there's an absence of sources is good ancient historian practice in itself, that actually being aware of absence. And we've got real absence here, haven't we? There's very little to go on. So talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I mean, for obviously ages, historians have wondered. I mean, it's always a risk to rely on the story from only one side, in this case, obviously, from a Greek author. And so people have asked themselves, is it possible to construct this history from the other side, you know, to create a Persian version of the Persian Wars? And, you know, to cut a very long story short, the answer is no, we don't have the sources to do that. And it's very important to be honest about that and to just say those sources aren't there. There is no comparable narrative historical tradition. That is to say, we simply don't hear of Persians writing the kinds of historical narratives that Herodotus set out to write. And so the only thing we have is some items of iconography. That is, we have pictures on seal rings and stuff like that of Persians who inevitably beat Greek hoplites or Greek-looking figures. So they have a sort of picture of what their victory looks like, which obviously isn't the story that we know, and it isn't really a story at all. They're just like these little scenes. And then beyond that, the only thing we have is royal inscriptions, which are obviously the most biased source you can possibly imagine in terms of what they're trying to achieve. It's glorifying the role of the Persian king as the bringer of order and justice in the world. And so understandably, but also generically, like this is a source that doesn't go into detail. They don't like talking about specific events. They kind of stop doing that around this time. So there is literally no reference to the invasion of Greece, let alone its failure. So in any Persian source.
Yes, I think I'm right in thinking that the Greeks are just mentioned as one of the many peoples of the empire. So they're there in the Persian consciousness, but there's nothing important or special about them in any of these inscriptions, is there?
So the Persians like to brag about all the different peoples that they rule over, and this is a very important part of their royal presentation. So both in palace reliefs and in royal iconography, they make a very strong point of stressing all the different peoples and making sure they're all like recognizable in their local dress and, you know, with their local produce to deliver up to the king. So there's a very strong sense of trying to show the spread of the Persian Empire. And justifiably, the Greeks are part of that because some Greek communities, especially those who are on the west coast of what is now Turkey, were under Persian rule. It's just that the Persians essentially declared that by that measure, all Greeks were under their command, and they never stopped saying that. So there's no point at which they said, well, actually, these Greeks have managed to push us back. We have to admit we don't rule over them anymore. It's like, no, this is a fact once and therefore a fact for all time. And there's no differentiation between Greeks and all the other peoples. There's not even necessarily any particular order in which these peoples are mentioned. And they are just one of the many that have become subject to the Persian king, as is, you know, the will of the gods, essentially the will of Ahriman, the god of the Persian kings.
Okay. And again, just trying to see what we can pick from the Persian motivation. Can we say, we accept, I think, that Xerxes was on this invasion, you know, that Herodotus and every other source tells us that. So if we accept that must be true, does the fact that the great king comes on this expedition and this attempted conquest into the Greek mainland, does that tell us something about the importance that he's attaching to this?
I think it does and it doesn't, actually, because sort of setting the whole invasion against its sort of broader context, so much of it seems to have been about establishing Asia Minor and the Greek cities of Asia Minor as the sort of the outer reaches of the empire, and trying to stabilize that bit. I mean, that's the bit that they always want to get back once they've lost it as a consequence of the Persian Wars, because economically, that's what gives them access to the Aegean and to the Mediterranean. And so much of Persian empire building is about revenue and revenue raising. And so they're trying to push beyond that in order to make sure that border becomes quite solid, which of course it becomes completely destabilized by the Persian Wars. And it's not until the 4th century that they find a different way to reintegrate the Ionians of Asia Minor or the Greeks of Asia Minor back into the Persian Empire.
Well, we're left with a bit of a mystery on the Persian side there, but we can maybe make some educated guesses and thoughts. Could we also just think, when we think about sources, about archaeology and epigraphy? So we can go to the battle sites. Of course, if you go to Marathon, you can see the memorial tomb for the 192 Athenians that we're told by Herodotus died there. And you can go to Thermopylae as well. What can archaeology or epigraphy inscriptions tell us about this invasion in 480-479?
Well, of course, there's the serpent column, which is now in Istanbul. It was at Delphi. It was the victory dedication made after the Persian Wars, which has the names of the Greek states that took part. And that in itself is very interesting because it's such a small number. There are only 31 on there. So it provides a sort of a counter story to the story that we have, you know, of Greek unity in resistance. So it wasn't quite as unified as it seemed.
Yeah, and we're going to come on and talk about that. But just to say for our students that is a prescribed source, that serpent column. And it's very interesting indeed, and tells us quite a lot about the who's fighting and in what order, perhaps. Okay, and archaeology role, is there anything we could talk about there?
Well, I mean, it's kind of annoying that battlefield archaeology in the Greek world is relatively underdeveloped. It hasn't been done very much, and there are some reasons for that. I mean, partly because it's often difficult to determine exactly where conflicts took place. And sometimes, as in the case of Thermopylae, if we know where it happened, we are very certain of that, but it's buried under 70 meters of essential deposit from the mountain falling into the sea. So basically, it's very, very difficult to find anything in that. And so a lot of those traces are either gone or have never been fully found in detail. So you have the mound on the battlefield of Marathon, which helps us to both locate that battle and to find, you know, there are Persian arrowheads in that mound, for instance. There are physical remains in that mound. But beyond that, there isn't all that much. And in terms of, for instance, Persian equipment, there is almost nothing found, to my knowledge, in the Greek context. For the parallels of the kind of things that Herodotus describes, we actually have to go into the Persian heartland to find those items. And in terms of the Greeks themselves, we only have like a few of these dedications, like the serpent column. So, for instance, there is a helmet inscribed with the name of Miltiades deposited at Olympia, but it's a Greek helmet. So you're also kind of like, what do we do with this? So maybe it's his own helmet, or maybe it's the helmet of the Greeks fighting on the Persian side. The upshot of all this is fundamentally, although there are a lot of little interesting bits here and there, they don't help us to rewrite this story.
Okay, so the students are now getting a real sense of the challenge that they have in trying to work out these reasons. But again, that's good from an ancient historian point of view to be aware of that. Make sure you follow the Classics podcast on Spotify so that you'll be the first to hear about each new episode. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and make sure you follow us on Instagram at The Classical Pod. For bonus materials, check out our website, classicalassociation.org/podcast.